Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
You know, I think one of the privileges of doing a podcast like this and being able to interview so many different people is this opportunity that I have to step into other people's lives, not only their films, not only their stories and their books and their essays and the things that they do, but also just getting to know them a little bit. But it's also incredibly frustrating. Our next guest is Steve James. He's a world-class filmmaker, documentarian. You need to find out what Roger Ebert has to say about Steve. But we are talking today about his new film, Abacus, and the subtitle of the film is Small Enough to Jail. I hope I have your interest already, not only about the interview, but more importantly about the film, which is opening up in Toronto in the very near future. So it's playing in early June for at least a week to 10 days, and I'm pretty sure it's playing at Hot Docs. Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Fascinating story, fascinating film about the financial crisis. It's a film about legal and criminal reform in our justice system, in frankly, in the West. It's about the 2008 financial crisis. It's about the little things. It's about narrative. It's about story. It's about empathy. It's about stepping into other people's lives and seeing how they are, in fact, making a difference here and there. It's also about It's a Wonderful Life, and you're going to need to find out why. And doesn't everything come back to George Bailey, really, in the end? So please do stay tuned, and don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my podcasting. Coming up on 300 interviews, and also special guest for that, and also about my speaking and my writing, and don't forget rabble.ca as well. And if you want to support what I'm doing and help me keep Face to Face on the air, you can do that through patreon.com. Stay tuned, don't touch that dial. Steve James coming right up, talking about Abacus, his new film Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by another very special guest here today with us, a documentarian, a filmmaker, somebody that you probably heard of before, and one of, I think, Roger Ebert's favorite documentarians. Steve James is here with us today to talk about his film, Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival this past fall. Steve, thanks for taking the time today to chat with us.
Great to be here.
So, It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, how many interviews have started talking about It's a Wonderful Life in relationship to your film?
To this film?
Yeah. Well, or how about to all your films?
Well, I think this is the first.
Okay.
With this film. And, you know, it's been interesting because I think a lot of people have been very intrigued by that connection.
It's a wonderful connection, by the way, on so many levels. My wife and I watch it every Christmas, and honestly, I see new things every year.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty great film.
Well, there's this beautiful quote here, because I do want to talk about that a little bit, from RogerEbert.com, a review by Brian Tallarico. James, quote, in particular, has an amazing ability to capture entire communities by focusing on a few people within them, close quote. That's all. I mean, there's lots we can take from out of that. And what a wonderful thing, A, to say about not only your history and your filmmaking and your approach and your storytelling, but isn't that kind of what it's really all about in a sense?
Well, it is a very nice thing for him to have written. It is kind of about that for me. I've always approached storytelling from the vantage point of wanting to follow individuals, people. And that I don't tend to come to films often as an issue I want to explore, but more I'm intrigued by a situation or that people find themselves in or crossroads. And then inevitably, I think the I've realized this about myself is the people that fascinate me the most over the years are people whose lives do indeed have something larger to say about the world we live in, but it doesn't have to be strained at to make that point. It sort of comes out of their very stories.
Is it about in a sense the little things making a big difference in a sense?
Well, if you're talking about this story, I think this is a story about a little bank that actually made a big difference in their community.
Right.
But that to the outside world, outside of Chinatown, they were virtually unheard of and no one seemed to care. I mean, even when Abacus was indicted and the DA of New York, Cyrus Vance, in his big indictment where, he created something of a spectacle by chaining together all these mostly ex-employees and
it's quite
Abacus.
Quite remarkable footage, too,
right.
in such a tragic way, really.
Yeah, and marching them down the hallway for the cameras, he made a big show of saying that this is the kind of fraud that led to the 2008 mortgage crisis, which was a ludicrous claim. But what was striking about that, one of the things that was striking about that to me was that did get the attention of the mainstream media.
Right.
It got in the New York Times and other places, and then nothing. Everyone left that story as if to, presumably, it didn't matter enough to report on. And I think the very fact that it was a small community bank that was being singled out as part of the 2008 crisis when it was patently false made it an important story to be told.
Yeah, you actually, I'm pretty sure I heard you in an interview, it might have been around the TIFF time or even recently, where you said somebody asked you often I would imagine you get this question, why are you drawn to a story and so on? But you said, first of all, it's a great story, but it's an important story.
Yeah, it's absolutely an important story. and I think that again, I think because Abacus was a small, unheard-of bank, it's the 2,651st largest bank in the United States. So, we put that in the film.
Line.
I think that, and because the fraud that was going on there was so low level and really didn't amount to much in any kind of grand scheme of the things, I think people, I don't know, I'm just assuming that there was that people assumed that, well, they're small, they don't really matter, and they're probably guilty, or why would there be 19 people being, paraded down the hall?
Well, isn't there a tragedy, too, to that sense of, let's say somebody saw that image on the on the news, and then you cut to, you're making a documentary about this family, and they're now talking around dinner, or they're at a party. Oh, hey, did you guys see that image? Did you see that report on that bank that finally went down?
Yeah.
And there's a sense in which it's sort of, it kind of levels things, I suppose, in a way. And is that the injustice of it, in a sense, for you? Or layered, I would think.
Yeah, I think the injustice happens on a number of levels. I think one is certainly that in this country too often is to be indicted is to be assumed to be guilty.
Right, right.
And
yeah, it's good.
And in a lot of cases, that may be the last you hear of someone being
right.
Indicted, and then you never really hear the outcome. Something like 98% of the people or institutions indicted in this country eventually plead guilty and don't go to trial. And that tells you something, because I am certain that 98% of the people charged are not guilty. They're not all guilty. And what that means is that there are a lot of innocent people who are just pleading out instead of facing the prospects of a trial, which they in all likelihood probably can't afford, and which they fear that if they lose, they'll just get a worse sentence.
Right.
So you have a lot of innocent people pleading out. And I think in this case, the DA's office was probably assuming that Abacus would eventually cop to a plea and avoid going to trial because of the sheer expense of it and the possible public embarrassment of it. And in that respect, they figured exactly wrong with the Sungs, because the Sungs believed in their innocence and they were not going to go quietly into the night.
And they were going to fight for it in their kind of almost reserved conservative way.
Yes, they are very they're a very close-knit family, a very humble family. I mean, Mr. Sung, the patriarch who started the bank in 1985, I mean, he really is a kind of elder version of Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. You know, he's very tall and lean, and he has a prideful bearing, and he's a very principled man and something of a stoic. And I think that, you know, when I met this family, when we started to make the film, I didn't know if they were truly innocent or not. And I kind of, you know, arrived at a judgment fairly early on from just being around them that I couldn't conceive of them being guilty, not just based on the facts as they were, but based on their character and how hurt they were to be charged with this crime, a family that took such enormous pride in doing the right thing and giving back to their community, to be charged with this was just something they never expected would happen to them.
It's kind of interesting what you were talking about, you know, Steve, about injustice and near the end of the film. So let's bookend it here. So at the beginning of the film, I think Thomas says something to the fact of, you know, in reality, life is not quite as simple as that, right? And I think he's referring to kind of the
Jimmy Stewart,
the way it all plays out. Exactly.
Right.
It's a wonderful life, but that comes with a few footnotes.
Yeah.
But at the end of the film, one of the lawyers, and I can't remember his last name, but Kevin is, you've got quite a tight close up on him. And he says, well, either you're a felon or you're not.
That's right. Yeah. Because
I mean, it's really not quite that clear cut.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because he's talking about as the case goes before the jury, there's many, many counts against them that the jury will have to weigh in on. And, you know, it's not like a football game where if you win on 79 counts and lose on one, then you've won. That's not the way it works. You know, as he says, if you're convicted on one count, a felon is a felon. And, you know, and of course that's not something that's lost on the prosecution in cases like this, which is one of the reasons I think why they throw a lot of counts at a defendant, because they don't need to win the majority of the counts to be victorious. They just need to win one.
So when you went into this, did you have the sense of, I want to make a film about the greater crisis, the greater financial crisis, I guess, if you will, as if a way to, I don't know, to give back to the community, the global community, to say, hey, well, hang on a minute here. There were a lot of different kinds of casualties.
Well, I think that, you know, it's funny because some people remarked that you know, this is a film about David and Goliath, and in this version of the story, David is a bank, actually.
Right.
You know, I think that, you know, I think of this story as, you know, yes, I think of this story as a reminder of what happened in 2008 and what didn't happen.
Right, right.
Meaning,
more importantly, almost
the lack of justice brought to bear on the big banks. But I also think of it as a film that's very much about what banking should be more about and seems to be less about these days, which is about the community that they serve, and less about shareholders getting maximum profit, you know, which is what goes on with the big banks. And that's where the Jimmy Stewart Wonderful Life analogy, you know, fits most aptly into this story, is that the thing that George Bailey, you know, in It's a Wonderful Life took a whole film to realize was that he really was doing something profoundly important for his community by carrying on the savings and loan in Bedford Falls, and where he parts company with Mr. Sung of Abacus is that was the very reason Mr. Sung chose to open the bank to begin with,
right.
Is that he wanted to serve that community. And so he had a sense of his place and role in that community that he took enormous pride in.
So when
this case came along, I mean, just how much more devastating could it be to be accused of being like the big banks and taking advantage of the system and taking advantage of people?
By the way, congratulations. It's a remarkable film, and you're right. It's great and an important story on so many levels, and I hope everybody gets to see it.
I hope so, too.
What's kind of beautiful for me, or a reminder to me, is, and I'm horrible. I live my life by the to-do list. I'm so not present. I'm always, what's next? And my kids have helped me with that. My wife Elizabeth has helped me with that. To me, it's a reminder of, there's probably a lot of us, in fact, if not all of us, are doing these wonderful acts of, can you say they're acts of kindness or giving back to our communities in ways that we don't even imagine? Here's George Bailey, who makes this decision, who doesn't want to make this decision, who doesn't want to go into this, and yet ends up giving back to all these lives, building this community. Bedford Falls would have been this way, or it could have been that way. Right?
Right.
And I think that's a remarkable thing. There's something profoundly, redemptive about just, being a human being and taking care of others.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think that one of the things that the Sungs realized after they were charged with this crime and then set about to fight it tooth and nail was that what they were going through was about more than just them and their bank.
Mm.
That the fight that they were fighting was really on behalf of their community, and on behalf of, the little guy,
right.
We're kind of everywhere facing, the Goliath of the justice system. And I think that's one of the reasons why they were agreeable to be filmed, not knowing where this was all leading, not knowing what the outcome was going to be. They didn't say we agree to be in this film if it turns out to be an innocent verdict. That wasn't the ground rules at all. They recognized that regardless of how this turns out for them, that it was an important story to be told, and that it wasn't going to change their belief in their own innocence.
I think, there's some profound insights for me in the story, in the film, and the way it plays out. And one in particular, the judge, and help me out here with the language, but the judge says before you head into, to the jury, he's speaking, only look at the evidence in this case. Don't look at this like this is some sort of, gavel that's got to fall on the whole system.
Right.
This is just the evidence. Steve, is that ever possible? I think it's a real interesting comment on the bias that we all take.
Yeah, well, that judge was really impressive. We got to talk a little bit to him in and around during the jury deliberations, and the Sungs would tell you that they thought he was an impressive judge in the way he handled the trial. And I think you're right. I think what he recognized was that there was such a residue of anger and resentment towards the way this went down with the big banks that he feared as a judge that the jury would in fact be thinking of the big banks as they went into their deliberations. And you know what? He was right, because there was one juror, and it's not the juror Jessica who appears in the film. We wanted to be clear about that. But there was a juror who absolutely felt strongly that way, that someone needed to pay for what the right. big banks had done.
Doesn't matter if they're guilty. What was the line? We need to make we have a broader responsibility to make an example or something along those
yeah,
lines.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, that juror heard the judge admonish them to not do that, and then turned around and did that.
Right. So how do you stay, or maybe you don't, I don't know. I don't know you well enough at all. We've spent all of, 20 minutes on the phone here, but how do you not become deeply cynical about the system, about this whole notion of, you know, how can you even talk about justice? You know, if it comes down to these types of subtleties and nuances,
yeah.
You know, I mean, really, you know, to me as well, this film in its own kind of nuanced way, we got to talk about criminal reform here.
Yes. Well,
legal reform, not criminal reform.
Yeah,
but legal reform.
I am not a cynical person anymore by nature. When I was much younger, I was definitely more cynical in my own sort of personal way.
Is that experience or alcohol that's had that impact?
I think that I like to think I've grown a little bit, but
right.
But alcohol helps. If
that's right. Yes, it's those shots of vodka. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
But while I'm not personally so cynical, I think a lot of that is actually, in all seriousness, due to having made documentary films and met so many remarkable Brazilian people over the years in making these films. I think that's had a big impact on me. But I am pretty cynical about the state of the justice system and the sort of, you know, the power and the way power is wielded in this country. I am pretty cynical about that. So I believe there are good people. There are lots of good people, and there are a lot of good people putting up the good fight, and there are even people within, you know, power who are laudable and fighting the good fight. But it's a tall order. And the deck does tend to be stacked too much against good people. So if you're a fan of the series The Wire, as I am, that's kind of what one of the things that made The Wire such a remarkable series, which was it took on these institutions and looked at them with a very jaundiced eye, but it did find good people within those systems who were endeavoring, tilting at windmills, trying to do the right thing.
Well, all the more reason why we need the Thomases and the Georges of the world to kind of, in their own way, whether it's intentional or not, to fight back.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, the splash and, I mean, part of what I want to do with, you know, my podcasting, my teaching, whatever it is I do, is just to say, you are making a difference. The question is it good for good or for ill, you know? And let's just maybe turn the heat up a little bit and all move forward together. I mean, there is reason to be hopeful. You know, it seems to me anyway.
Well, there's, I think it depends on what day you're talking, I do think there are days where I'm hopeful and then there are days where I'm not, but there's always a reason to keep trying. That never wavers.
Can we get to who said that if you want to rob people, don't steal, or if you want to steal from people, don't rob a bank, just open one.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who that was, but probably Mark Twain. And if it wasn't, we can just say it was Mark Twain. You seem to think that otherwise, though. This family seems to believe otherwise.
Well, I think, again,
you know, we want to give back to the community.
Yeah.
What he said? He actually said something, I think, Thomas, near the beginning of the film about this is an honorable thing. Taking people's money, you know, we're entrusted with their funds. This is something we can do for society.
Absolutely. Well, Thomas Sung saw need. He lived in Chinatown at that time. He was a successful lawyer. He had a perfectly good career going, but when he went to a bank and wanted to borrow money, they weren't too interested in lending money.
Right.
And this is a successful man. And that's what got him thinking. Mm. It's sort of like, if I can't borrow money in Chinatown from my bank, what about all these other folks who are struggling to get by or, you know, who aren't professionals like myself? So that's what spawned the idea is that, you know, I could continue to practice law or I could do something that I think, and even in his practicing of law, he was giving back to his community, but he decided a more potent way to do that. Was to open a bank for his community. And, you know, the evidence of his success was you just have to walk around Chinatown with Thomas Song and you see.
Oh, it's remarkable. It's just so It's a Wonderful Life. It's yeah. crazy. You know, it takes me back to the end scene of the film and so on. I mean, clearly this family believed in a home and not just, you know, the object of the house. I'm not opening a bank to give loans so people can buy houses. No, I'm doing that so they can go and create, you know, families and homes and build something from the ground up. It's really, really quite remarkable. We're going to have to wrap it up here in a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you a couple more questions if you've got a second here.
Sure.
The one of the images for the film, in fact, might be on the poster, the safety deposit boxes
yeah.
with some of the family. I mean, clearly intentional. Can you unpack that a little? I mean, I'd love to unpack it, but can you unpack it a little bit for me? Because it's a remarkable photo.
Yeah, well, at one point early in the film, Mr. Sung took us to the basement of the Abacus branch where his office is and showed us the 8,000 safety deposit
right.
boxes in the basement.
Wow.
You know, which was remarkable.
Yeah.
And of course, we, you know, it's visually striking, and we filmed him down there, and then we photographed him down there, and that's the image that ultimately became the poster for the film. But, you know, what it said about their commitment to the community was amazing, which is, you know, for immigrants coming to this country, you know, I think we tend to forget. The safety box seems like a relic of the past for many of us, or something you see in movies, you know, caper movies, and that's about it.
Right.
But in a place like Chinatown, those safety deposit boxes are where people kept their money and their valuables and the things that were precious to them, you know, that was the home for those very important things to them. And the fact that Abacus, you know, had 8,000 boxes at its disposal for the community spoke volumes about that need, but also the bank's place in that community in fulfilling that need.
You know, so film's opened premiere was at Toronto International Film Festival back in the fall, but it's opening up in Toronto shortly. We'll put some information about that on our site. Can we talk a little bit about what you're doing next? Is that a possibility?
Sure. I'm in the middle of we've shot now, but we're smack in the middle of editing a documentary miniseries. I live in Oak Park, which is the first due west suburb of Chicago. It's a historic suburb.
Okay, so I just for the record, I live in a suburb called Oak Park.
Do you really?
How crazy is that? I swear I'm not making it up. Yep.
Well, so Oak Park here is is a historic suburb.
Nice.
Frank Lloyd Wright had his
ooh cool
studio there. He built some homes there. It's where Ernest Hemingway was born.
You live in a way cooler suburb than I do.
Yeah, although I do not live in a Frank Lloyd Wright house.
Right, okay. Let's be clear. Yeah.
But in the present, its significance has been that it has been, for a number of decades now, an incredibly diverse, progressive community that takes enormous pride in all that. And it's a place where a lot of people move to when they have children of school age because of the public schools, too.
Right.
And so, and all our kids went through the Oak Park public school system. And, you know, they got a perfectly fine education. But one of the things that the community has struggled with for literally decades is its inability to close the equity gap in achievement between its black students and its white students.
Wow.
And I, for years, have wanted to do a film focused on race and on education in a place like Oak Park because it is not a poor public Chicago school in a besieged community, you know, ripped by violence. Oak Park is none of that. And yet what's going on there, it seems to me, is something very important to be explored. So we were able to go in there for a year and film a bunch of students that we followed and their families and teachers. And we are now editing it into a miniseries that's going to be called America to Me, which is lifted from the Langston Hughes poem, the key line of which is, it's a poem about how America has not been America to so many immigrants and different racial groups in this country. And the key line that we lifted our title from is, America never was America to me.
Hmm. Well, to bring it back full circle to the review on RogerEbert.com, the writer Brian, he says, you know, you're somebody who find ways to tell big universal stories by telling small individual ones, and I think that's a gift and a really beautiful thing. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it. Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. We've had the director, Steve James, chatting with us here today on Face to Face. Steve, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I hope we can talk about America to Me in the future. As I said, I hope everybody gets to see this film.
Yes. Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking immensely.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.